welcome, folks. We're up to episode 8 of season 12 of Mention and Dispatches. And when we get to the spring, around the middle of the season, it's pretty reliable that we're going to have an episode or two that features some of the folks from the professional wargaming community. So we try to sync this up around the same time that Connections Online starts to appear on the calendar. And, you know, lo and behold, here we are approaching end of March, early April, as we are getting close to Connections Online, which means we got to bring back the guy in charge of Connections Online. So Chris Weave is back again. Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, except I've caught that cold that's going around, you should avoid it if you can. But other than that, I'm doing great.
Yes. Chris, please do not spread any computer viruses. Joining us for the first time here on Mention and Dispatches, although no stranger to the professional wargaming community, Pete Pellegrino is here. Sir, how are you tonight?
I am well. End of a long day. We've been, you know, workshops and stuff going on at the War College, but otherwise, good.
And so for the folks know where Chris has been, and like, you know, he doesn't speak for his employer. They don't speak for him. We're not anticipating the same for you. You're at one of the War Colleges, as you mentioned. You've also, over the years, you've got 20 odd years worth of professional wargaming under your belt at this point though, right?
That is correct. Yeah. And, I stumbled into it. I started at the War College when I was still active duty Navy. I showed up there in 2004. Then I wasn't supposed to go to wargaming. I was on my way over to the teaching faculty when the personnel department screwed up and the position I was going to take, the officer I was replacing, he extended. And so because he didn't leave, you know, his job wasn't open and they didn't know what to do with me. So the basic idea was, look, how about we stick you in wargaming as a temporary thing and we'll work it out later. Okay. So that was 2004. I'm still in wargaming.
So. Look, it could be considered temporary when you eventually finally decide to change and go back to whatever you're supposed to do.
Right. We call it Act 3 because I'm on Act 2 right now. Yeah, because I retired in 2007 and basically just kind of went from, you know, one of the wargaming cubicles in a uniform to two down to the left in a coat and tie.
Yeah, yeah.
See, well, he disappeared for a month and came back with a beard.
Well, there was that part, yeah.
Because that's what Navy guys do when they retire.
That's how we mark our retirement, is we all immediately grow facial hair.
Well, it's that or you get on a submarine and grow the facial hair, one or the other. So
as you can guess from the fact that I jumped in there, Pete and I actually worked together at the War College.
You did.
I was there from 2005 to 2010. And it was funny. Pete is such a natural to the position, picked it up like a fish in water, such a natural to the position that I constantly, I remember our boss's boss in some intro or something, he talked about how Pete had been, you know, Pete had been wargaming since he was a kid or something like that. And I went up afterwards and said, that's not true.
That is correct.
Pete wasn't a wargamer until he got here. And the response I got was, really? Are you serious? It's like, yeah. So, I mean, Pete's one of those guys who just, he picked it up right away, immediately understood how all the pieces fit together, went from having to be told that wargaming was one word to being able to say, this, you know, this is what you shouldn't do when you're designing a game, and this is how you should do it. And the Pellegrino Cross is how he explained all that stuff, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he went from a cold start to being an expert in the field in what, 18 months?
Something well, like that. What I learned to do is, again, a mutual colleague of ours, Stephen Downs Martin. My first assignment was with him as my analyst.
Right? He just threw you right in the deep end.
Yeah, kind of. And again, Stephen, you know, self admits that he has the social skills of flesh eating bacteria. And what I found was, if I could just repeat what Stephen said in a way that didn't irritate people, I was golden.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see how that would work to your advantage.
That was true. I mean, Chris said my gaming background is, yeah, I had a little bit of a, you know, gaming background in terms of, you know, I played Risk as a kid, but I kind of joke that was the extent of it. You know, Risk, Stratego, I think I just covered it, chess. Again, just kind of fell into it. And then it was one of those happy circumstances in terms of, or coincidences, where I was at the War College. And that month I disappeared. Part of that was as I retired and I came back. But when I came back, as a contractor, but the college didn't immediately pick up, you know, expand the contract to pick me up on full time. So the extra time that I wasn't at the War College, I ended up doing some business wargaming for like Fortune 500 companies.
Oh, wow.
Which was, again, just kind of a happenstance. I just kind of fell into that. And again, that was an interesting experience because I was able to start to take the, you know, my, at that point, only 3 years of military wargaming and do the whole, okay, so we've always said that gaming is gaming. It's just the context that changes. Is that true? So I took a lot of what I'd learned at the college off to a couple of different businesses who were trying to use gaming techniques to understand their competitive space, their market opportunities and stuff. And it's like, yeah, it does work for them too. And then from that, I fell in with Hasbro for a little bit in terms of just doing some consulting and outside inventor work for Hasbro for a while. And that was the check of, okay, so what about the commercial side? You know, commercial entertainment gaming, does that fit within the professional skill set as well? And it all does. So it was all kind of sympathetic or synergistic.
Yeah. We're going to circle back around to both some of the business and the commercial side of things a little bit. I do want to go back to your whole sort of, I stumbled into it, I fell into it. It's interesting that, so only now are we starting to see some more deliberate pathways really laid down for people mm-hmm. who want to go into professional gaming, you know, in this practitioner space where folks like Sebastian at Georgetown with the Intro to Wargaming class there, or some of the other, you know, Chris Wheaton had some stuff like that up at Mercyhurst for a while before he left for the Army War College. But you're starting to see in a couple of places some deliberate academic development towards some wargaming expertise, and Moores has started to pick up on this a little bit. But for folks that are probably over that 30, 35 year old line, there's nobody really that I can think of in the professional wargaming space that intended to be in the professional wargaming space. Everybody, you know, sort of stumbled back. It's kind of like being a business analyst in the IT world. Like the person who went to school with a career goal of becoming an IT business analyst, that person does not exist. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them stumbled into it or backed into it or fell into it by accident from somewhere else. And I think that's true of a ton of wargamers as well. And so sort of, Chris, same thing happened with you. You know, you just sort of you applied for a job and ended up working for Peter Perlow one day. Talk about, you know, winning the lottery there. But, you know, Pete, as you look at it, like you admitted it was sort of an accident that you ended up in that space. In terms of some of the preparation and the skills that you brought to the table that weren't necessarily wargaming skills, but turned out to be very useful over the long haul, what were some of those things that kind of helped you, not just, you know, because obviously you kind of had to enjoy the wargaming stuff, but what were some of the skills that made it, you know, more appealing, more successful for you?
Yeah. So when I told my parents where I had kind of landed and what I was doing, both of them were like, well, yeah, duh. I'm like, wait a second. What do you mean, duh? In terms of, I didn't see this coming. How is it that you thought this was a natural fit? And they said, when you were young, don't you remember you would go and get a scrap piece of cardboard and go and raid pieces from other games we had laying around the house and make other games to play with your brother? And I was like, I did? Okay. If you say so, I guess I kind of vaguely remember doing that. And I think it was that some of those early just knocking around other games. But what the glue that kind of held all that together was really more from the graphic arts and creative side of things. So when I teach part of the wargaming course that we do at the college twice a year, one of the topics I kind of point out, right, or analogies I use is this idea about art, the arts. And I contrast my own experience in terms of formal art training. So going to university, I went to Penn State, and you have to take so many, you know, humanity credits and art credits and whatnot. I was a biology major, and I took all studio arts. So 3D design, 2D design, graphics, painting, color. I got my hands in there. I wanted to do it. My wife, by contrast, was more of the art history person. So she can sit there and look at a painting and tell you which Dutch master did it, what the significance of his use of oils and color is, why this is considered a masterpiece. She can't draw a stick figure to save her life. So I think it was that art side that really helped in terms of that creative space in being able to take the necessary abstraction steps. Because wargaming, you know, from that professional level, it's you're either starting from nothing and building up, which is a little harder to do until you've been doing it for a while. So most of us start from that top down approach. Is you take what you know about warfare and you figure out what parts you're going to abstract away or cut off, and how do you simplify what's left. And that's, and I think that's kind of an art process, because that's, you know, from a visual design and communications idea, that's what you're doing. You're trying to think about a complex idea that I have to somehow reduce into simple visual cues that I can represent in some sort of like 2D media to communicate an idea. It's like, gee, that's the challenge we have with wargaming. How do I take complex military problems, abstract them down to some simpler representation of them? But in doing that, I can actually communicate perhaps more or understand more than I want to look at the real world problem in its entirety. So I think maybe that's part of what helped me adapt to this job.
Yeah. It's funny with the whole parents, you know, kind of saying, well, duh, you know, because that was, you know, an area that you sort of jumped into for the creative side in terms of applying the military knowledge and thought to those game contexts. Was that just something that came primarily from your experience in the Navy, or was there a different history interest ahead of that as well?
Yeah, there's a little bit, I'd say mostly just 20 plus years in the Navy in terms of the, you know, the military planning process. While on the Navy side, we tend to get introduced to that late in life, but I attended the British War College, was what I did for my joint professional military education. And so the mechanical process, the step-by-step procedural approach to how do you think about a problem? How do you define it? How do you understand its implied tasks, its explicit tasks? How do you start developing those courses of action? How do you think about the intelligence part that you need for all of this? I think it's an important part of, from a wargaming perspective, having that background helps you look at and decompose military problems, which is you're either doing it because you're a planner and you're somewhere at, you know, one of the military commands and you're trying to actually do a plans job, or you're a wargamer. You still have to do that same type of deconstruction and understand the pieces, parts that compose operational art, as we like to call it. And there was the history part. I mean, I ended up spending a fair amount of time researching, and now I lecture on it, the interwar period at the War College, because when if you're at the War College, if you're involved with wargaming, sooner or later someone's going to bring up War Plan Orange. And if you're at the War College, everyone gets dewy-eyed, the edges of the screen go into soft focus, gentle music plays, and it's this, oh yes, the interwar period when we are a halcyon days of wargaming at the War College. And I knew nothing about War Plan Orange, but I kept hearing this mythology around it. And so at some point I said, you know, I should read something if I'm going to work here. And this seems to be something that people always want to refer to. And so I picked up Ed Miller's book on War Plan Orange and read it through once, read it through a second time. And at one point I started just, you know, taking notes in the margins and started thinking about it in terms of how can I make a book report? That's kind of what I ended up doing. And so I put together a little presentation, and it was more just, again, for internal, for the department. It says, hey, if you're curious about War Plan Orange, I don't think the story is exactly the way it tends to get told around the college, but it's still a useful story to understand. And my intro to when I give the talk is I liken War Plan Orange and the way we talk about it at the college to the way we talk about Thanksgiving, you know, as a national holiday. And there's the imagery that goes with Thanksgiving, the turkey, the belt buckle hats, the black and white outfits, the Puritans kind of thing, the Wampanoag Indians, and the history of it, especially if it's here in Rhode Island, because we're at ground zero for King Philip's War here. So
yeah.
The actual history is not quite so, you know, so celebratory after you get past about the first 50 years of the colonists hanging out here in New England. So, but it's still important. The myth part is still important because it in some ways informs what we want to be, you know, the ideals of the American character, and how Thanksgiving tries to embody some of that. It's our least commercialized holiday. So even though we've mythologically, or mythicized, come up with a word there.
Mythologized.
That. Thank you. I'll go with that. the holiday. It's that is still valuable, just as its actual history is still important to understand. So that's how I kind of lead in with Warplane Orange. It's the college's Thanksgiving. We've got a lot of myth around it about how, like, you know, the college figured out how to defeat Japan in World War II. The reality is a little less exciting. We played an important role. We didn't play the role. We didn't write the plan at the college. But again, my history interest there is kind of what informed that. And now that's become a whole secondary thing, is that at least a couple, two, three times a year, I give this Warplane Orange talk. And I think the reason it's stuck around, so to speak, in terms of how often I'm asked to do it, is I think there's a little bit of a, I don't want to say cautionary tale, but there is a tendency today for people looking in at professional wargaming to oversimplify what we do and simply say things like, oh, well, can't we just replicate the wargaming we did in, you know, 1920 to 1937 and figure out how to defeat our current adversaries and just do that. And I have to point out to people, the reason that wargaming worked as well as it did in the 20s and 30s is that it was part of what I call the ecosystem. It wasn't just the gaming. It was the fact that we also had the fleet battle experiments going on. We had OpNav, which was still relatively new, with its own war plans division. You couldn't get to the war plans division unless you were a War College grad. The War College curriculum was 90% wargaming centric. So we were spitting out students who had spent almost a full year just doing war games repetitive. And then we were sending them off to be those fleet commanders who then did those fleet battle experiments. We were sending them to all the bureaus, so Bureau of Aeronautics, Bureau of Navigation, Bureau of Weaponry. And from there, the technology piece was meeting up with the actual field experimentation piece, was meeting up with the theoretical piece down to the War College, is being tested out in wargaming at OpNav from a war plans perspective. And around all of it is the general board, which no longer exists. So it's because we had all of that going on, and we had our students as the vehicles to disseminate wargaming knowledge throughout the fleet that made it work. So you can't just go and pluck the War College piece out, drop it into today's naval environment in terms of the relationship with OpNav, the way the fleets function, we're Goldwater Nichols, the change in relationship with the fleet commanders. So it's not just that straight lift from, well, the way we did it in the past, we can just do it now. Not that we couldn't do it better now, but yeah, that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
One of the things about it is that it was, because it was part of the curriculum, nobody like said, oh, how do we do a wargaming thing, right? It was just there. It was just part of the curriculum. And pretty much the entire Navy officer corps went to the War College. I think there were two flag officers in the Pacific who were not War College grads.
Yeah, I think there was only one. Yeah, just one.
Oh, maybe it might have been one. Okay.
Yeah,
I stand corrected. And so the end result of that is it wasn't like, well, we need to come up with this thing that will sort of graft onto things. Now I've worked for the Navy in one way, shape, or form for about 20 years. I now work for somebody else, but I spent a lot of time working with and for the Navy. And I love the U.S. Navy, although sometimes the Navy makes it really hard. And one of the things I've noticed about the Navy, bless them, is that there's this tendency to adopt the conclusion slide while rejecting the assumption slide. And so if you go to them and say, oh yeah, you want that? Well, here's what it's going to cost. And they'll say, yeah, but I don't want to pay that. I want to get the benefit of it, but I don't want to pay that cost. So how about we do like 1/10 of what you said?
You've just described every single person on a weight loss and exercise regimen.
Yeah, yeah.
In the entire country. Like you've just described, 90% of America's New Year's resolutions,
well,
right?
Yeah,
there.
But it's a recurring theme. Like at one point the Army had a particular course, and I can't remember what it's called now off the top of my head, that was producing some really, really well qualified operators, but it was taking them like a year. And the Navy's response is, we want that, but we're going to do it in 6 weeks. Well, guess what? They didn't get those results because it was only 6 weeks. That's kind of a recurring theme. And so anybody who's in the professional wargaming business knows very well that wargaming is a pendulum. Professional wargaming is a pendulum. And it cycles back and forth between being everybody, you know, oh, yeah, we got to do wargaming. We got to do wargaming. We got to do wargaming to don't tell me about that wargaming shit. And it cycles back and forth on maybe about a 10-year cycle on that.
Yeah.
And you know, okay, that's a gross generalization. You know, it's not exactly like that, but it does have a tendency to wax and wane. And then in addition to that, wargaming is an ill-defined term. It's not actually covered in the joint documents anymore. There used to be a wargaming definition, but for some reason they took it out of the dictionary.
That is indeed true, yeah.
And
well, it's not just that it's ill-defined. It's used as an accurate label on like six different things.
Yeah, well, we call it the big tent, right? Wargaming is a big tent.
And then you've got things like phrases like advanced wargaming. And, you know, a lot of people think that when, you know, if I'm talking about a war game, I'm talking about some sort of computer simulation program. And what I care about is the answer. It's like, you know, if I just had enough detail in my war game, it will give me, it will tell me if my war plan is good enough. And it's like that drives me crazy. War games, for analytical purposes, war games are not analysis. War games generate data that needs to undergo analysis to be turned into knowledge. And the outcome of any particular war game is just one data point in that regard. And frequently, you know, your war game has objectives that come out of a problem statement. And those objectives, how well you meet those objectives, determine how successful your game is. And frequently, the best way to meet those objectives is to design a game that is not quote unquote realistic, but rather it's fit for purpose, right? So like if you're testing stuff related to air combat, you don't necessarily want to have a big ground component in your game because it's just going to distract the players to go and do stuff. And somebody will come along and say, well, you didn't include the ground game and some of the red would have been doing ground stuff. And it's like, yeah, and I don't want them doing ground stuff. I want them doing air stuff because that's the part I'm testing. I always say that wargaming, there's two different kinds of wargaming. There's wargaming that's like developmental test, and there's wargaming that's like operational test. Operational testing is to determine if the thing that you're going to buy does what it claims it does, right? So, you know, I'm going to buy this tank. Can I use this thing as a tank? Does it meet the survivability requirements? Does it meet the mobility requirements, et cetera, et cetera? Operational test is about breaking the damn thing so you can figure out how it breaks so you can make it less breakable. So operational test is like an eye exam. There are no, you don't win an eye exam, right? You don't pass an eye exam. Well, I guess you do if you're going to be a pilot or something like that. But I mean, just when you go to your eye doctor, there are no recorded instances of an eye doctor saying, I've run out of increasingly tiny letters for you to look at. You win, right? It is a test to destruction. And so a lot of gaming, a lot of professional gaming is a test to destruction. And the pros understand that. Well, most of them do. Not all of them, because people come in from various paths and sometimes they're not in the right environment. The environment that they're in has not sort of taken that on board.
But I'll go ahead and say it. The good ones do.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, roger that. The leadership doesn't always get that. And so a big chunk of being a professional war gamer is figuring out how to educate leadership, including sponsors, but not always sponsors, educating leadership on how to think about gaming. And it's not a matter of getting people enthused. Frequently, it's a matter of explaining to the enthused guy that he's wrong, which is always fun. Especially when they got stars on their shoulders.
Yeah. Why you want to harsh my mellow, dude?
Yeah. Well, and I think part of what when Chris was talking about the whole, you know, just gaming primarily, human decision driven. Right? If I don't have humans involved making decisions, I've got something else, but I don't have a game. And then we get into this argument, but it's this idea about, and this is the chicken and egg problem within gaming in terms of I've got decisions that result in consequences. Based on those consequences, I have to make more decisions. So decision, consequence. Where do I start the wheel? Do I start with the chicken? Do I start with the egg? Because it makes a little bit of a difference. So when we say that a game primarily wants to start with, here are a set of conditions. What do you do next, Commander? That puts the decision process front and center. The decision is the result. Or do we say, you've made some decisions, here's what happens, which tends to put the what happens front and center, and less so about the decision. Now, each feeds the other. And again, that's why it's a wheel and why it's a little bit of a problem in terms of trying to figure out which should you start with. But our argument has been, at least recently, we've been trying to articulate this way. If you're simply interested in setting a bunch of conditions, making some decisions, coming up with a strategy, getting the council of captains, the big thinkers to put together a strategy, and you want to see what happens, well, then that's when we do some of our gaming that uses models and simulations, campaign analysis. You set the conditions, you hit the run button, you come back in 3 days, and see what the boxes spit out, which clearly isn't, from a gamer's perspective, much of a game, if any game at all, as opposed to, hey, here's a set of conditions. We're fourth and long. What are you going to do now? What's the team going to practice? How are you going to respond to the situation? Now, some people immediately start to say, why am I fourth and long? It doesn't matter why. Yeah. You're stuck here. This is the situation that you find yourself in. How do you think your way out of it? And it was, well, I need to know how I got here. No, you don't.
Because they want to go back and change the conditions that got them into fourth and long.
Right. Part of one of the things that one of my colleagues talks about is this idea that one of the things that word gaming can be good for is trying to understand where the irreversible and irrecoverable branches are as probability goes forward in time. So if you think of just, you know, we're here in the now. And the further I start to move into trying to guess what's going to happen in the future, the fuzzier it gets. I can probably guess what's going to happen in the next 30 seconds, but I'm not so good at guessing what's going to happen in the next 3 years. So that ambiguity horizon, you know, gets gooey and fuzzy, the broader this tree of possibility moves out with all these possible branching decisions I can make. So one of the things that gaming tries to do is prune all those possible decision branches. You can get to this point and go left or right. Okay, let's go right. Okay, let's see what happens when I go left, right, left, left, right. Oh, that didn't turn out so good. Okay, well, how bad did it turn out? No, it turned out catastrophic. Huh. So what I'm guessing is you'd rather not repeat that pattern again. So let's figure out what the road signs are that you're starting to go down that pathway. Because if it's truly irreversible, it means you've put yourself now into such an extremis, you can't back out, an old flyer. And that's like getting into the Box Canyon, where you fly in the Box Canyon a little too long, and you're going to find that the terrain is rising faster than your aircraft can climb. You are going to hit the wall. So you're in an irrecoverable situation. And so you can't back out and you can't recover from it. I'd rather not be there. So can I game to start to see and understand the signposts that start to say, dude, you're heading down towards one of those bad pathways. Let's not continue. And you kind of now prune that off of your decision tree, saying, hey, I went down that path. We can find no good way to wring benefit from it. So let's cut that one off of our future thinking.
You learn how to recognize the dead end signs.
Exactly. But then I have senior officers say, yes, that's what I want. Keep pruning away all the branches until there's a stick left that goes to victory. Okay, now my trimming the bush problem, my analogy just fell apart, because I go, well, okay, no, I can't do that.
The best comeback, yeah, I've ever heard to one of those was actually an Air Force captain who was observing at an event at the National Defense University. Mm-hmm. And I was there supporting a thing as a contractor. And there were a couple of other observers who were in the room doing exactly what you talked about. They're like, you know, I just want them to figure out, like, what are the right set of decisions we've got to make to get all the way through to victory. And this captain leaned over to me and said, you know, if we had that answer, we wouldn't need those guys.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's anyone who gets into the hey, we can predict it. They're selling their model, or they're selling their approach as working as a reliable predictor. And I look at people and say, look, if what they're saying is true, they wouldn't be in this business. They'd be in the stock market. They'd be in sports.
Yes. Because
there's a whole lot more money there.
Why? Are they broken?
I want to spin this back real quick to what wargaming in Newport in the interwar years actually meant for a second, because Pete talked about Warplan Orange, and Warplan Orange was a big part of it. But the Naval War College, as he said, like 90% of the curriculum was based on wargaming stuff, and they were wargaming at all sorts of different levels. And there's this famous letter that came from Chester Nimitz, right?
Yep.
And Pete and I are required by federal law to mention that letter. As former War College employees, we have to mention that letter at least like once a week or so.
Yeah, 1965.
Yeah, and it's this letter where he said, we weren't surprised by anything except the kamikaze. Let's put this in context.
Yeah.
The context of this is they were wargaming at all sorts of different levels, and the war games changed over time. So I'm going to talk broad brush about 30 years of wargaming. The war games changed over time, and they covered all different levels, so it wasn't just like, what should our strategy be? And oh, we've got this default strategy. Does our operational, when we do the operational game, does that fit in with the strategy? It was also a lot of tactical play. So, and the tactical play frequently changed fundamentals in order to prevent the students from gaming the problem, the gouge, as we would say. And so part of that was, you know, like when you talk to the guy who was in the class ahead of you, and he says, oh, you know, the torpedoes are killer. You know, guns aren't that big an issue, but torpedoes are going to kill you. And you talk to the guy in the class before that, it's like, oh, it's all guns. It's, and the torpedoes are useless. And, you know, other variations of that. And it's like, did these guys go to the same place? And it's like, yeah, but they didn't play the same game. Because frequently for those tactical level classes, what they were doing was they were constantly changing those variables. They were changing the die roll tables that they were rolling against. Because it wasn't, those games were not about being able to execute the game. It was about teaching students how to think through problems on the fly under situations of extreme stress, and teaching them how to figure out what world it turns out they were living in, because we didn't know, right? We hadn't fought the war with those weapons, and so we didn't know. So when Chester Nimitz says there were no surprises, part of what he's saying there is we did every possible combination on the gaming floors in Newport, and so, you know, nothing that happened was a surprise, not because wargaming predicted it, but because they did everything.
Yeah, I mean, we joke about how within that time, you remember when, so Nimitz is a student in 1923. So obviously 20 years are going to go by before he actually has to do the job. And then another, give or take 20 years, a little less, goes by before he's at Spruance Auditorium, or no, he's at Pringle Auditorium, at the War College in 1960, talking to the student body. And again, this is where also the Nimitz or the kamikaze thing comes up. But when you listen to, and we've got it recorded, and it's part of, it's called the Gray Book, which are all of the personal memoirs and papers of Nimitz that the War College was bequeathed, and we've since digitized. And that's one of our digital records. And as you listen to him talk, he's talking about professional military education, and he's trying to put that emphasis on the full quote in terms of the war with Japan had been fought by so many people in so many different ways. And that's the important part, not the rest of the that follows. It was the diversity of people who had to think through the problem set and the environment they had to think it through and the changing situations. Because again, here's Nimitz playing with dreadnoughts and biplanes, 1923. Right? That's obviously not the Navy he took to the fight. And by 1960, he's got a pretty decent sense of hindsight. And he would know as well as probably the best in terms of everything the war games got wrong.
Yeah.
The war games got Japanese torpedo performance wrong. We got Japanese naval aviation wrong. We got night fighting wrong. We got utilization of radar wrong. We got a lot of things wrong. Submarine tactics wrong. Yet he never said, oh, well, you know, I gamed in 23. A lot of it was inaccurate. Wargaming didn't really help me 2 decades later. He doesn't say that because, again, as Chris has pointed out, it wasn't about trying to memorize the right thing to do if you find yourself west of Palau in the Pacific. It's how do I think about problems? What are those mental habits of mind, is the phrase we like to use, that wargaming inculcated, because they did it for a year. It wasn't just a one-off, oh, today we'll do a little bit of wargaming. It's, no, that's what you did. That's how we taught, was through the wargaming. And so it's that type of thing that built those, they built the Halseys, they built the Nimitzes, they built the King. But King, the story we like to tell about King, he's class of 33. When King is, it's his turn to command in one of the war games. And the faculty tell him, okay, Ernie, you've drawn problem three, and you need to do the approach to Japan via the northern route, which is basically hugging the Aleutians in the northern islands. And King doesn't want to do that. And he's like, I don't think that's a war-winning approach. There are better ways to approach Japan. I don't want to do that. I'd rather do the Central Pacific approach for my war. And the faculty's commander at the time, you're not listening. We need you to do the northern approach. And the reason why is because it's a curriculum. Again, this isn't, we're not trying to discover the way to defeat Japan. We're just trying to expose the students to a variety of operational, strategic or tactical problems that happen to be set in the West Pacific with against Japan, a likely opponent of the United States for a variety of reasons. And King just keeps pushing back. I'm not going to do it. And finally, the faculty says, okay, Commander, if you'd like to pass on your chance to command, duly noted. And King rapidly goes, okay, hang on. Yes. And he acquiesces. Now, he gets pulled from the course early for different reasons, and he'd actually probably have to do the game. But again, to Chris's point, it was a curriculum. We're trying to teach some stuff, and it's not necessarily teaching you how to cross the T as is trying to teach you to think dynamically in a situation with limited information, confused timelines, and be comfortable with analyzing a situation. And we think, at least that's what I think. I think when Nimitz says he's not surprised, it's he didn't get caught on the back foot. He didn't get caught in a situation that he couldn't reason his way forward from.
Yeah.
That's...
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things there. I mean, one, you know, the context that you provide in terms of they changed every possible condition that they could. It's easy to not be surprised when you cover as many bases as possible. You know, the likelihood of being surprised goes down. Not that it's impossible, but it's a lot less likely. The thing I really want to grab onto here and come back to a little bit is, you know, Chris, you had talked about wargaming as a bit of a pendulum, and I want to hold that thought for just a second. But Pete, you talking about, you know, at the time in those interwar years, there was, you know, the War College was wargaming. It was, here's a problem, let's solve it. Check out. No, I'm kidding. But like, you know, we go through the problem set in this class, and we're going to use that to teach this lesson. And then, you know, the bell rings, you go down the hall to your next class. Okay, here's the next, you know, for this curriculum or this subject, here's this war game we're going to put on the table, and we're going to use it to try and teach you how to solve this other problem, to where that's what they were doing. I'm sure somebody somewhere along the way has taken a look at the history of wargaming at the Naval War College and figured out that at this certain point, that 90% became 80%, became 50%, became 10%. Yeah. And they've looked at that. But the question in terms of, like, how do you get back to, assuming there's a desire to, how do you get back to such a high level of wargaming for the instruction? And Chris, where I want to come back to your whole pendulum thing, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of that Bob Work memo that came out in the DOD that said, hey, we need to get back to wargaming more in the service schools. And this needs to be a bigger deal. And we need to make sure that we're wargaming all the time at all levels in every class in every place. And all the folks in the professional wargaming world and folks like me that are sort of adjacent to it all cheered and went, well, yeah, this is great. And then it didn't happen. And I think Brandt's sort of two cents theory on some of this is it's the biggest part of this is because it doesn't get back to Pete, what you were describing, which is this becomes an expectation in every classroom you walk into, every subject, every week, there's some sort of war game happening on the table. Part of it is the trainers don't know how to do it. They don't understand how to incorporate this into the curriculum. Part of it is every time you change senior leadership, like the focus of the curriculum changes. So that doesn't help. You know, that runs in 3-year increments, but the people designing the curriculum, and more importantly, the people executing the curriculum, don't know how to do it. So it never becomes an everyday expected thing in every service school from the E4 to the O6 level, that every single time you go to some sort of professional military school, there's a war game a week happening. Because that's part of how you learn these things. How do we get back to that?
I'm actually gonna push back on a couple of your assumptions. And because I think most of the things you talked about are fixable, if that's what you wanted to do, right? If the issue is
fixable,
no. But so, and now I'll get to why they're not fixed in just a moment. You know, if the issue is that you want to have, you know, every course has to have a bunch of wargaming in it and stuff like that, then you know, that's just a matter of training people to be able to do that. We used to be able to do it, right? It's not that wargaming is so far beyond the understanding of people that they can't do it. I think the much, much bigger deal is that the mission of the War College, at least in terms of the type of degree that it gives out, is dramatically different than what it used to be back then. It used to be back then that if you were a graduate of the Naval War College, it just meant that you were a graduate of the Naval War College. And that had no relevance whatsoever unless you were talking to somebody else who was in the military, because it was it wasn't an accredited degree program. The Naval War College today gives out an accredited master's program. It's a master's degree. It's considered a political science degree. It's national security and strategic studies. At least that's what I was told in 2008 when I got my war college degree.
Yes, Sam.
And the faculty is largely civilian. Now there's a lot of military folks there. They try to set it up so that in the day school, in all of the discussion sections, at least they used to, that there was a military professor and a civilian professor. But there weren't very many civilians there back in the interwar period. It was pretty much all military, and it was solely about training them for war. Whereas my degree program, so I took a course in strategy, I took a course in joint maritime operations, which was sort of the operational level of war. So how to plan campaigns. The first course is about why you want to have campaigns and how you can use campaigns to achieve strategic effects, and how to think about strategy. And then that other course is about how do I do that. And then there's a third course that's everything else. And it included things on how to interact with your professionals from other countries, right? You know, there was a section on the Japanese in particular, because we do a lot of stuff with the Japanese. And I remember one of the readings we had on how to interact with the Japanese said, you know, if they're not used to dealing with Americans, you should treat them this way. And if they are used to dealing with Americans, if they're used to dealing with Americans, they'll tell you no. If they're not used to dealing with Americans, they'll never tell you no, but you need to be able to understand what a no looks like anyway. But they're not going to use the word no.
Well, so and, Chris, you're talking kind of real particularly about the Naval War College, probably because that's your guys' shared experience. I'm talking about, like I said, everything from E4 to O6. And again, going back to my frame of reference is the Army. So that primary leadership development course that you send E4s to turn them into sergeants, all the way up through the War College and everything in between. So the basic NCO course, the advanced NCO course, the sergeant major course.
Understood. But my point is the aperture is a lot wider than it was in the old days. And so a big chunk of the courses in Newport, how would you war game it? I mean, it's because it's not about combat. It's not about battle. And there's a lot of things along those lines that from every level. Now, the Naval War College, they will let lieutenants in, but they generally don't want to let a whole lot of lieutenants in because it's really for lieutenant commanders kind of the sweet spot there, right? People that have already finished their department head tour and are beginning to sort of bring their gaze up, right? Bring their gaze up to look at the rest of the world, not be about the narrow focus of their specific community. And they're just, you know, these days, officers have to know a lot more than they used to. And part of their requirement is they have to, at some point in their career, they have to go off and get a master's degree. And so the Naval War College actually wasn't competitive in terms of attracting students who were naval officers until they decided to make it a regular master's program. The joke was people would go to Newport for the golfing, and it was considered kind of a vacation.
I'd have thought they'd have gone to naval postgrad for the golfing.
Moderated.
Well, you know, but the funny thing about that is that the Naval Postgraduate School is a hardcore technical school. Right. You get master's degrees from there and you get master's degrees in things with numbers and you write regular theses and stuff like that. I mean,
I know it also happens to be 4 miles from Pebble Beach. So,
yeah. It's got that going. You know, I'm not saying that Monterey is a hardship tour by any stretch.
Oh, I know. Look, it's my wife's hometown. I've been there I've been stationed there a couple of times. So
yeah, a really good friend of mine is a retired submariner who has a degree in spacecraft design from the Naval War College, from the Naval Postgraduate School. And he met his wife there who was getting a degree in anti-submarine warfare. So, which is just,
that's a perfect combination right there.
It's a perfect combination. So the thing is that it's not just about, you can't fix this problem just by changing the curriculum, because there's too many pressures on that make the curriculum the way it is. You'd have to do a much, much, much more fundamental reset than just sort of saying, like, we need to do wargaming in the curriculum. The other thing about wargaming like that, and this applies to the Work Letter, I'm sure that Bob Work understands this, because Bob Work is a really sharp guy and he's doing wargaming from the beginning of time.
The 12th season of Mentions and Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Michael Sunborg, Fred and his dog, Chet Bell, Hellcat 6, Patrick Geraghty, Stagger Wing, Kevin Bertram, Mike Quigley, Martok, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Regiment of Strategy Gaming, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming articles, events, and this podcast. You can join us as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Wargaming can be for training, it can be for education, it can be for analysis. And all games have a tendency to have bits and pieces of all three, right? There's very few examples of a pure game. Training is about teaching you procedures. It's about which button to push when. Education is about how to think about the problem. And then analysis is about generating data that I can then use analytical techniques on to analyze the problem more. Going back to the War College in the interwar period, most of that gaming was educational gaming that was about teaching students how to fight battles. What we talk about is the analytical gaming that was about War Plan Orange. Now, those were frequently, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, there was this bright line painted down the side of, you know, across the hallway, and they had one on one side and one on the other, right? You know, people learned, there was lots of education that happened in the War Plan Orange battles. But I'm pretty sure that if you go back and you pull the thread, it's different people that are doing those different things. And we have a tendency to just kind of mix it all up.
Yeah.
It's the problem we have with World War II in general, is that people, and this applies that entire time period. From where we're sitting, it's this bunch of stuff that all sort of happened at the same time. It didn't happen at the same time. It happened over 30 years. And it had a bunch of different people involved in a bunch of different organizations, et cetera, et cetera. But to us, it looks like it was just this thing that happened at a time. And you can't really understand situations like that unless you like sort of sit down and figure out the exact timeline of how things came about and who was doing what, et cetera, et cetera. It requires and put yourself in the perspective of what did the people know at the time, right? Tiny little sidebar, few sentences. If you look at those first, say, four carrier battles in World War II, three or four, if you look at the 1942 carrier battles, they were learning how to do carrier warfare. And it was very personal to these guys. And a lot of it was, okay, we fought Coral Sea last week and we got our asses kicked in certain ways. And so we're rewriting all the tactics manuals so the next time we fight them, it's going to be different. And then they go and they fight Midway and they go, oh yeah, these are the same assholes we dealt with before. Actually, I think it was Santa Cruz and Coral Sea that were the ones that were a month apart, if I remember correctly. And it's like, yeah, those are the assholes that we fought a month ago. And this time it's going to be different because we've rethought all this stuff. There's a lot of detail that gets lost from our distant perspective.
Yeah. And to the original point about the curriculum. Yeah. The Joint Staff study, J7 study, basically came out and said JPME is broken across the services, and everyone goes, yeah, we're it's hard to push back against that when you look at what it is joint professional military education was supposed to accomplish, and the throughput, the types of students we're going through now, what the curriculum has morphed into. What there is an agreement is how to fix it. And as Chris alluded to, it would take some pretty severe personnel changes and curriculum changes to try to drag the quote unquote drag the college back to the old days, and whether that's the right approach or not. But what certainly the faculty is sensitive to it, because I did not realize that especially amongst the civilian faculty at the War College, how sensitive they are to that criticism in terms of we teach far too much stuff that isn't about war fighting. So not long after I put together my book report on Ed Miller's book, War Plan Orange, I was invited to give it to the president of the War College. And I thought it was just like, he was just curious. Yeah, it's sure. I'm happy to show him my clever PowerPoint book report. And I think it's going to just be me and him. So maybe it's a few extra people. So I get over to where I'm giving the talk, and the room is filled with a bunch of deans, the provost, Pinwick,
the tribunal.
Yeah. Yeah. And an alarm bell should have been going off in my head, but they weren't, because I'm just here to give a book report. So I give my book report, and suddenly I find myself in what felt like my dissertation defense, where I'm getting attacked about the presentation in terms of, am I suggesting that we need to get rid of all the civilian faculty, that I'm here to advocate for going back to a particular, I'm just talking about Ed Miller's book. I don't know where you people are coming from, but that's what it was. I later learned that, this is the problem of this idea that we have become too civilianized in the faculty. We are teaching too many topics that do not directly relate to warfare, and there is a push to go back. Well, that's a difficult thing to undo. You know, the bell was rung in the 1970s to shift the curriculum to much more of the liberal arts model, the liberal arts college model. Mm-hmm. And that was done with, you know, malice and forethought. There were parts that they tried to preserve from a wargaming perspective. This would have been Admiral Turner was the president at the time. And one of the things that he saw, the trend lines, was the computer gaming problem that we were having at the War College. So we get the computer, 1957. We start using the Naval Wargaming System and NWIGS. And it, you know, it's massive. It's the 50s. Everything is, you know, it's punch card, magnetic tape, giant, the UNIVAC rack-mounted computers. And one of the promises of computer-based gaming was that it was going to accelerate game, because now all that pesky paperwork and umpires looking up combat tables is all going to happen in the blink of an eye inside of the computer. Well, that was part of the problem. It happened inside of the computer, and the computer became a bit of a black box. Wargaming became a black box activity where students would try to come up with moves. They couldn't enter them into NWIGS. You had to have a trained operator who would sit there and convert their doodles on a chart into commands the computer would understand. Computer would run and would come back and just tell you submarine's dead. And he was like, well, what happened?
Yeah.
Submarine died. What do you mean what happened? And Turner realized that we had lost a visualization activity, an important part of it. We had lost a tactile sense of how close did I come? What were the odds? Did I push my risk? And it kind of got lost in what was, again, called black box gaming. So
the submarine died. Did the submarine die because the probability was that the submarine was going to die? Or did the submarine die because a really, really, really improbable event happened?
Yeah. And you can't tell with the early setup. So he was pushing for a return to more board gaming, manual gaming, because we could do it faster. It didn't require the massive reset times that NWIGS did, or NEWS, the Naval Electronic Warfare System, required. And it gave the students more opportunity to command, because this is where we started to lose to the fleet. Up until the 1970s, the preponderance of wargaming at the college was for the students. We don't have a wargaming department, by the way. This is something that is always kind of, because we say the sign, the big logo says wargaming department, wargaming since 1887. True. The techniques were formalized into the curriculum not long after the college opened in 1884. We're using a lot of heavy wargaming techniques as a teaching tool starting in about 1887. The wargaming department as a named department doesn't come along until the computer does, because we actually need specialized people to take care of it. And this goes back to Chris's earlier comment. Everybody wargamed because that's how we taught. It would be like having the blackboard division or the chalk division. It just, everyone just knew how to do it because it's what we did. It yeah. wasn't until it became so specialized because of the computer that we have to stand up a separate department now with a very niche skill set. Not that the wargaming part is niche. It's the babysitting the computer part that's niche. And yeah. that's kind of why we end up as that department. But the students lost out. The fleet found out that we had a computer and the fleet wanted computer time. So increasingly, the War College's bandwidth was devoted to supporting fleet commanders who are trying to do campaign analysis, war planning, et cetera. And it's not time for the students. Now, the student time doesn't go away altogether, but it's dramatically less than it had been under the old manual gaming days where it was the teaching technique.
So yeah, I've always liked James Stewart's point about manual versus digital wargaming in that the model is much more transparent. If you need to make a change to something in a manual game, you need a Sharpie, not a computer science degree.
Right.
Right. You're not recompiling the base code in order to make a change to something or hoping that the code guys built in an editor for you. Right. You need a Sharpie. Yeah. You know?
There's an old Avalon Hill game called Tobruk, which is a very interesting game. People have one of two reactions to it. They go, the game is fantastic. It's just like what an operations research analyst would design. Or they say the game is horrible. It's just like what an operations research analyst would design. And the thing about Tobruk is that when you take one tank under fire, when you shoot at a target, you roll dice against a series of charts, and you go to a chart and you roll you start off with you know what you're firing with, and then you roll a die and you take the result of that table and you go to another table and you roll a die and then you follow the bouncing ball through about six or seven of these charts. And in practical terms, it's, does my round go through the box that the target is in? Does my round having hit the box that the target is in, does it hit the part of the box that the target is taking up? And so now you start getting into what the target type is and how big it is and what its shape is. Where does it hit? What angle does it hit at, and what sort of penetration it has? And you follow the bouncing ball. Now, there's no decision making made. The only decision making is at the very beginning when you say, yeah, I'm going to shoot at that target. But you have to do this series of die rolls to get out at the end. It could be one die roll. It could be a, you know, roll a D1000 and just look it up and do it all in one step.
Roll five different colored dice and just follow your way through the charts.
You can do that, but that is a different player experience, because what those charts do is those charts are a model, and you can follow the model as it executes. Now, that D1000 lookup table that you could be rolling against is also the output of the exact same model, but it's totally and completely opaque to the user. And so that's why when people say things like I, at one point I was talking with a guy who was going to republish that game, and he was going, yeah, we're just going to do it as a D1000. And I and the other people that were with me, it's like, no, don't do that. What seems to you to be a useless die rolling exercise is the heart of the game.
And that kind of goes to the point of what is the point of the game, right? Because we've got game, you know, the college plays everything from strategic deterrence games, thermonuclear war, down to, now we don't go down to the tactical level so much. We often consider the tactical level at the adjudication level, but the players typically kind of cap out somewhere around operational or what we call high tactical. Not sure what that means, but, and again, what is it that you're trying to illustrate? What is it you want them, where do you want them to spend their decision space, and where do you need to automate things? Because it's not of interest. It doesn't illuminate the problem that the sponsor has articulated. So how do I structure the game to get at the pieces that matter? And we call this making sure the players have agency. Mm-hmm. I want my adjudication process to be sensitive to the levers the players can pull. Because if most of what happens in adjudication is a reflection of engineering, of elements beyond the control of the player, if my player is playing a maritime commander, and the most important thing for that DDG to survive the incoming missile attack is that the little tiny pretend captain on the little tiny pretend destroyer turns his ship to put the threat on the beam so he can get more missile directors looking at down the threat axis. Okay, well, the player didn't make that decision. My players don't sit there and send in, hey, I want DDG number 4 to turn to 0-2-0 and speed up to 21 knots. They're going, I allocated resources to achieve an effect in the battle space. I need an AAW capability out there in order to defend something. I need to put force over here in order to shape the battle space in a way that'll compel my adversary to move into this more hazardous ground where I can take him under fire. You know, and when those are the sorts of decisions you want the players making, what I don't want then is to have that very generic get sea control in the Strait of Malacca order be what the player submits. And now adjudication gets to play the game where they go, oh, well, if I have this order now to get sea control, I'm going to do a bunch of stuff. Well, wait a second. Who is the player?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. And this actually goes back to one of the things that I always explain to newbies all the time, including bosses and stuff like that. Right. And this is the reason why you have to be sort of process oriented if you're going to be a game designer. And that is you have to get your problem statement correct. Right. And you got to work with the sponsor to get the problem statement correct to figure out exactly what the sponsor needs. And by the way, the worst sponsor is yourself. Easily. The worst experiences I've ever had was when I was working for the organization that was the sponsor of the game, that we were doing it ourselves. And then the second thing you have to do is you have to derive a set of objectives from that and a set of well-crafted, non-exclusive objectives, you know, things that don't interfere with each other to sort of figure out how you're going to solve that problem statement, right? And, you know, this is just like good project management, right? You got to understand the problem and then you have to sort of define like, okay, what do I have to do to consider that problem fixed, right? And so you need to do this in war games, and the DoD needs to do it in deciding what the war colleges are for, to go back to the previous discussion.
Yeah.
Right. The problem is, you know, they say JPME is broke, to which my response is, what are you trying to do with it?
Yeah.
And don't tell me you're trying to make better officers, right? Because that's the sort of wishy-washy response that got us there to begin with. Yeah. And the problem is, you know, I think fundamentally with JPME, there's, I think, two things going on. One is that there's lots of demands on people's time. And so you don't necessarily get the best and the brightest always going off to the war college all the time, because there's lots of other things for people to do. And, you know, ships are being rowed hard and put away wet. And there's plenty there. It's hard to get to pry loose SWOs to go surface warfare officers to go and do things like the Naval War College. So that's part of the problem. But the other problem is that they just don't know what they want out of it. And they're trying to do everything, and they need to. And they've come up with a set of objectives that are interfering with each other, right? I want it to be warfighter focused, but it's got to make them, you know, broadly capable. It's got to increase your experience base. It's got to be focused on the service, but it's also got to meet the demand signal for getting a master's degree. And so, you know, it has to be a degree granting program, because if I get to choose, if I'm only going to let the Navy's only going to send me to one, I'm going to get the one that's useful when I'm not in the Navy anymore. And so they haven't defined, there hasn't been the political will to sit down and define what they're trying to do with all this stuff and then come up with a solution.
Chris, I want to go back to something you were talking about a second ago in terms of, you know, with the war games, you've got to define the problem set and then figure out what,
yeah,
you know, ways in which you can approach that. I think that's very true of a particular kind of war game. And no surprise, it's the one where you've spent the bulk of your time. I think,
yeah,
kind of war game that you're using for, you know, giving somebody much closer to the front of the battlefield, whether it's, you know, a junior officer or senior NCO, somebody in that last 100 yards, last half mile, the kind of war game you're going to put in front of them is a very different thing, because it's a lot less analytical and a lot less about sort of decision-making practice under adverse or harsh or time-limited conditions. That's a different kind of war game than you're using during your deliberate planning process, whether it's the MDMP or some other planning process, where the point of the war game is to compare courses of action. That's a different,
yeah,
kind of war game than, as you mentioned before, that test of destruction. That's a different kind of war game than a doctrine development war game. I mean, we covered this during one of the Connections Online sessions, talking about the war game handbooks with the different kinds of war games that, mm-hmm, were available. You know, that's where I jokingly included the performative war game, if you remember, you know, the war game that,
yeah,
you knew to tell senior leadership you did a war game and nobody cares other than the fact that you did one.
I call that wargaming is performance art.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And so there's, you know, when you start talking about kind of the, you know, what's the problem set, I think that's a very accurate and necessary step for a particular kind of war game, but not necessarily all the kinds of war games. And I don't want that to end up sort of scaring people off.
No. I am going to plant my, this is a hill I will die on. Okay. This is a hill I will die on. Fundamentally, it doesn't matter the type of war game. You've got a problem statement of some sort and you've got objectives. Now, notice that I didn't say anything about analysis when I talked about any of that stuff, right? The analysis part comes later. After that, I think is when they start to diverge, when you start talking about research questions and stuff like that. You know, if you're not doing research, then that doesn't count. But in terms of like defining what your problem is, i.e., why do you think you need a war game? That's where that comes from, right? People don't just do war games because, you know, hey, let's just do a war game. Well, sometimes they do, and that's the problem, is that they've got an ill-defined problem statement. So for instance, if the issue is people don't understand their gear enough and they need training, you know, the problem statement is people don't understand what they need to do in order to operate their equipment, and there needs to be some way of instituting muscle memory, et cetera, into that. And then you sort of figure out what the objectives are that will define whether the game is a success by deriving. I always say 2 ± 1 is the number of objectives you want. And then that will tell you, you know, whether you've made it or not. And those objectives are a filter that you use in your design process. So like if somebody says, let's have a ground campaign as part of the game. And it's like, no, my guy's an AWACS operator. And this game that we're doing is all about about training him how to be an AWACS operator. I don't need to do the ground stuff unless the ground stuff is part of his job description.
No, but so, it would be more realistic, Chris. It would be more realistic if you put the ground stuff in.
Yeah. And I'm so sick of hearing the term realism.
We call it the realism trap. It's a trap.
Yes, it is.
It would also be more realistic if they did it in the dark on 4 hours of sleep in MOP 4 without having had a shower for a week.
Yeah, well, that's a joke.
So if we're going to go for full realism, that's fine. Everybody bust out your chemical suits and you're not taking a shower for a week. And, you know, I'm going to come wake you up every half an hour.
Yeah,
my response is fit for purpose, because I don't want a war game, for instance, where red looks at I'm not going to attack at the enemy base because I think it's too strong, right? If what I've done is I've designed a war game where the purpose of this war game is we've put a bunch of defenses at this base and we're trying to get a handle on how we would use these defenses in a battle. I don't want red to look at it and go, well, I'm scared. I'm not going to attack that. No, part of the instruction to the red player is going to be, you have to do that. And one of the things when I was up in Newport, I was part of something called Halsey Alpha. And one of the, which is a faculty moderated, student executed wargaming research project that's been wargaming a series of related topics over the course of 20 years. And one of the things that the Halsey Alpha faculty does is they are both the red National Command Authority and the blue National Command Authority. And so the red cell commander and the blue cell commander have to do a mother may I, you know, this is what our plan's going to be. And frequently they'll say, hey, that's a great idea. We'll write that down. Some group in the future will get to try that, but that's not what we're doing today. You know, we want you to focus on, it's, you know, we want you to take the northern route, commander.
Yeah, right.
Right. Exactly. So it's the exact same thing. And that's exactly what was going on there. They wanted him to take the northern route and they had very specific objectives to do that. And they were functioning as the National Command Authority, he was not a totally free actor. And so that's another thing that's interesting in the professional wargaming space is how much freedom do you give the players? Because you don't want to give them too much freedom, because paradoxically, the thing that makes wargaming such a powerful tool will come around to bite you in the ass. McCarty Little, William McCarty Little.
Yeah, William.
The wargaming building in Newport is named after this officer of the early 20th century. He wrote this essay called, Pete, help me. What's the name of the essay?
Yeah, I'm thinking the name. Is this the one? Keep going.
It's the one where he says that the reason why you war game is because People basically, people are smarter when they're being competitive.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's where the infamous quote comes. That the secret behind a war game is a live, vigorous enemy in the next room waiting to pull all sound. Yeah, yeah. I can't even. But that's the quote. Yeah, it's painted on the wall at the building.
Yeah, it's Yeah, it is, and it's totally true. And that's why wargaming is one of the reasons why wargaming is such a powerful tool, and why it makes sense to have people wargame rather than just do a structured, facilitated workshop all the time. Although a well-done structured facilitated workshop is a thing of beauty, and I should point out that Pete is perhaps the best facilitator I've ever seen at this. But the thing is that you also have to deal with players that will frequently try to subvert what you're trying to do because they want to win so bad.
Yeah.
And they're trying to find ways around you. And so that's why you need to make sure, you know, the blue cell leader and the red cell leader are creatures of the white cell. The white cell is traditionally the control group, right? They work for game control. They are not independent actors. This is why, and this is an entirely different subject that we should get into at another time, but if you go back and you read all the public discussions of General Van Riper in Millennium Challenge, this is the part where he did not understand, or he chose to ignore, the fact that he had a boss and that he wasn't the National Command Authority, that he worked for the White Cell. And so the White Cell got a vote on what he was supposed to do because they had objectives they were trying to meet, and they needed him to do certain things in order to meet their objectives.
Yeah, current.
That, whether those objectives were good or objectives or not is an entirely different discussion.
Right, right. Yeah, because that's a whole one of my a day's lecture is we use Millennium Challenge 2002 is the poster child for why you don't combo platter, live exercise, war game, and experimentation all into one event.
One of the most pleasing things that has happened to me professionally is at Connections US at National Defense University. I was giving the long version of my the other one. It was my Wargaming Pathologies talk, and I talk about Millennium Challenge in it, and I gave my take on it, and which basically is don't believe the newspapers. I wasn't there. I talked with a bunch of people who were. Here's how I put it together based upon what I've heard was going on inside the White Cell, and what I, as a professional war gamer, understand is how the Red Cell and the Blue Cell and the White Cell should be interacting and what the how objectives work and all the rest of it. And I spent about 5 minutes sort of laying this out, and a guy in the front row raised his hand, and I called on him, and he said, I was one of the guys in control. That is the best description of what happened that I've ever heard from somebody who wasn't there.
Yeah, so Chris, you'll be happy to know that I take your wargaming pathology brief. I give that first, then the checklist that, you know, is with that when you look for various things. Then I hand it out to all the students. We then watch a video on Millennium Challenge. And I have
fantastic.
And then I have them go through and I say, okay, so I have my checklist of, you know, the things that I think that video should have highlighted. What do you have on your checklist? Yeah, in terms of what they spotted as potential pathologies within the construct of the execution and the analysis that followed.
That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that that's happening. Yeah, so, that's fantastic.
As we start to get closer to wrapping this up, I want to throw this last thing toward Pete. You know, again, this is one of the podcasts where we're going to focus primarily on the professional wargaming world. But if we're going to circle back around to the hobby audience, for however many of them might still be listening over an hour into us talking about senior service schools and, you know, the halcyon days of interwar wargaming at the war college, at the Naval War College. But seriously, as we loop all this back around to a hobbyist looking at how the professionals are doing wargaming and what lessons they might be able to take from that or what ideas they might be able to grab and run with, are there any particular things that you've seen over your time, over your, you know, several decades now in the wargaming field in terms of something that would resonate with the hobby audience, something that would matter to them that they can learn from some of these lessons that we've picked up over the years in the professional realm, as you've seen it?
Yeah. So I do a lot of gaming for obviously the professional game, but I also do gaming for high school students, Sea Cadets, Boy Scouts, different groups. And obviously, and that is a much more of a entertainment and hobby space that I'm in. But most of the, so from a principles of war perspective, even the simplest hobby level game will echo the principles of major modern combat. So it still works. It applies. Mass is a thing. Movement is a thing. Fires matters. Intelligence matters. Targeting. All those elements that often get layered in somewhere, and whether it's you know, command points like in Tide of Iron, where it's just that's the way we've decided to represent it, that's fine. Gameplay in general, all gameplay, not just war game, but again, and that's obviously the niche here, but there was a brilliant column that was written in the Wall Street Journal several years ago, and the title of it was basically everything my kids know they learn from gaming. And it was this idea that gaming at any level is a phenomenally transferable skill set, and the mistake we make is when we think that our gameplay has to closely emulate the real world or life in general to be of use. And that's the pushback that this author had, this columnist had, was this idea that any gameplay is good gameplay. The opportunity to engage in an unnecessary problem, right? All especially in the hobby side of the house. When you decide to play a game, you have volunteered to spend your time solving an unnecessary problem, because that's what every game presents you. It's a problem to be solved. We start with some sort of starting condition. It is not the victory condition. We are now going to make a bunch of decisions bounded by a rule set that if I make the right decisions and interact with the other players around me, one of us is going to achieve a victory condition, solve the problem, and win. There is nothing life depending upon me playing another game of Risk with my kids. But we do it anyways, because all play is valuable. And this idea that it's an opportunity to engage in that artificial world and learn how to make decisions under different constraints. Games all provide some sort of constrained system in which I have to operate. I have to buy into this world. I have to accept the premise of this world and the way it works. And within those boundaries, try to figure out how to get my little car filled with my family to Millionaire Acres, how to wipe out all my opponents in a game of Risk, how to get all the property in Monopoly. All of that is problem solving. And problem solving, role play, is all crucial stuff. And when you then step out your door and hit the real world, it's not just entertainment. It is fun, but fun has its value in how we shape our thinking and how we approach problem sets well beyond the board game, the computer game, my miniatures game, my professional game. So kind of the big thing that I've kind of taken away with my exposure to the entertainment side, the business side, the professional side, is play is good, and we don't do nearly enough of it.
I think that's a great place to leave this for this week, that play is good and we don't do enough of it. So I think, you know, everybody go play more. It's a good thing. Tell them Pete said it was okay.
It's okay.
Chris, appreciate you taking some time to be here. Obviously, folks coming to participate at Connections Online 15 to 20 April are going to see a whole lot more of you. They're going to see Pete on screen for a little bit of it, and thankfully, they won't see a ton of me on screen, so that'll be great. And again, Connections Online, hobby folks, please come be a part of it. Come learn more about what the pros do and how they do it, and maybe you've got some good ideas to throw into the mixer that the pros can learn from the hobby side. So that's absolutely the point of why we put this together, and to do it at such a low barrier to entry, because you can attend Connections Online in your pajamas. It's totally, well, Pete probably can't because he's going to be at the War College. But
well, from the waist up or down. Or
yeah, well, but if you've got to walk through the halls in Newport in order to get to where you're sitting to be a part of this, the pajamas might be a little overboard. Just don't wear a nightgown.
What happens in Newport stays in Newport.
Fair enough. Go ahead, Chris.
If I can jump in for a second, you haven't actually mentioned what the topic, the theme of this year's Connections Online is.
Well, it shouldn't matter. They should come be a part of it no matter what.
They should, but it's the theme this year is distributed wargaming. Basically, what did we learn from COVID? You know, what lessons learned did we learn from the pandemic? Because everybody had to think about how can I do stuff remotely? And, you know, there's people that have been doing stuff remotely all the time. There's lots of hobbyists who do it because, you know, the single most difficult thing about being a hobby wargamer is finding somebody to play a game with. And so the hobby wargaming got into the distributed wargaming thing a long time ago. This topic is going to involve, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people talking about hobby examples, because that's where we had a tendency to jump to when COVID first happened. I mean, there was a lot of people regretting. Pete and I were ones, were two of them, right? That the skill set, the tool set that we had on the unclassified world was so much better than the skill set, the tool set that we had on our classified networks. Because, you know, like I can't use Discord on the classified network. I can't use Tabletop Simulator. I can't use Vassal. There's a whole bunch of specific gaming tools out there that were just not available to us.
Well, one of these days when we're all in person, buy me a beer and ask me about the Xbox on the Cypernet in Kosovo. It's a great story.
Oh, yeah. Weird shit always happens when they're deployed.
Yeah. Yeah. This one's a particularly entertaining story. So, no, cool. Guys, thank y'all very much. We promised an hour. We're up to an hour and a half. And, you know, look, with Chris here, that's actually cutting it a little short. So that's fine. But Pete, we do appreciate you stopping by and joining us. And hope you have a chance to come back and join us again on a future episode down the line. Chris, we know you're going to be back because, you know, you're always here. And we appreciate it.
I'll see you next March, if not before.
Yeah. Well, generally we get you here about once a season. So, you know, probably have you back in the fall for sure if you're not back again this season. And then audience, thank you guys for joining us. And we hope you got something out of this discussion of professional wargaming. We'll catch you next time on another episode of Mentioning Dispatches.